Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Now listen very carefully to what I'm about to say. It may not make sense to you, but hopefully by the end of the day it will. Health, your health, our health, a population health, is more dependent on socioeconomic factors than on the health care we receive. For example, social factors such as stress, neglect, and abuse early in life can affect the developing brain. This leads to social, emotional, and cognitive impairments. These changes can then lead to the adoption of high-risk behaviors, illnesses, social problems, and even a shorter life expectancy. To discuss this in more detail and especially explore how child abuse is affecting Alaskans, our guests today are Dr. Jared Parrish. He's a senior epidemiologist at the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in the section of maternal and child health. And Dr. Matt Hirschfeld. Matt is medical director of maternal child health services at Alaska Native Medical Center, where he focuses on developing and improving statewide services to improve the health and wellness of Alaska Native women and children. He's also on the board of the Alaska chapter for the March of Dimes and the Rasmussen Foundation. And he is president of the All Alaska Pediatric Partnership, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to decreasing child abuse and neglect across our state. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jared, this is your first attempt at this, and Matt's suffered through a couple more, so welcome.
I'm looking forward to it.
I would like to start by really trying to help listeners understand my introduction. I'm sure sounds unbelievable to some, and many may deny it, but things that happen early in our life can have profound lifelong impacts. How do we know that?
Well, so I think we've suspected that for a long time, and the first real study that looked at it was something called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. That was a collaboration between Kaiser and California and the Centers for Disease Control out of the federal government. And what they were looking at were 10 things that can happen to you as a kid that may or may not be affecting your health as an adult or even as an older kid. And the 10 things they were looking at were things like physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect. But what they were also looking at were some things that maybe not be as commonly thought about, such as mental illness in the home or a family member who was incarcerated. And what they found is that kids who had experienced these experiences, especially as young kids, as they grew up, almost all the health indicators that they looked at were worse in kids who had experienced one or more of these experiences than kids who hadn't experienced anything at all. And so as your number of yes answers to those questions increases, you've experienced sexual abuse, neglect, physical abuse. As your number of yes answers to those increases, your risk of having poor health outcomes as an adult go up exponentially. And in fact, one of the interesting stats about this is that your link between yes answers to those questions that happened to you as a kid is more strongly associated with suicide than smoking and lung cancer. So they're very strongly associated. And there's been tons of studies that came out since the original study back in the 90s, and they've all seen the same thing. As your number of yes answers increases to these adverse childhood experiences, your risk of poor health outcomes increases as well.
So anyone familiar with science can say, oh, yeah, well, there's lots of studies that come out. One of my friends I play golf with told me just the other day, is it coffee okay or not okay this week? So how many times has this been looked at? What's our assurance is that this kind of information is real?
So it's been looked at hundreds of times now. There's hundreds of studies looking at this, and it's very strongly you can never prove anything in science, but it's as strongly proven as you can get in science, and that these bad things that happen to you as kids affect your health outcomes as an adult. And it's a risk. It's not, you know, if you have bad things happen to you as a kid, you're not 100% guaranteed that you're going to have a suicide attempt. But your risk goes up, and your risk of heart disease and liver problems, alcoholism, drug abuse, problems with relationships, problems with keeping a good job, all those things, your risk for having problems with those increases as your risk of bad things happening to you as a kid increases.
And as you implied, as we say in medicine, there was a dose effect. So the more you have had exposures, it's not necessarily that one exposure is a bad one, but the more increases the likelihood of these findings.
Yep, and we every time this has been looked at, it's almost a dose response curve, which is one of the holy grails of public health. You very rarely get that, but as your dose increases, or the number of yes answers to bad things happening to you as a kid increases, your risk of bad health outcomes increases as well.
So what you're saying also, maybe we didn't say specifically, is when you see that dose response curve, it gives more credibility that the research, the evidence, what you're finding is true.
Sure. Yep.
You know what, Matt? We've also seen this across disciplines, too, that are approaching this problem. We've seen it in the psychology research, the mm-hmm. clinical research, the public health research. And so that also helps us corroborate this evidence.
And when you don't have any negative studies that show that it doesn't happen, that helps as well. Every study that I've seen has been a positive study saying that this dose response curve exists.
Let me take a second. I often, because I get so engaged in these programs, that I forget to let people know how they can call and ask questions. So if you have any questions or you have comments about what you hear today, if you're in Anchorage, you can reach us directly by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can also email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And that line one is spelled out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. So how can we figure out or explain the mechanism that early stress, you know, living with family members with mental health, being subject to abuse and neglect, having alcoholism or drug abuse, how can that mechanistically be explained to lead to long-term problems?
So that's some of the newest research coming out in this area, and that's a subject called epigenetics. And everybody's heard of genes and DNA. Those are the building blocks of how you build a person or a cell or a plant or anything. What's interesting is that it appears that the adverse childhood experiences don't actually affect your DNA directly. What they affect is how you regulate genes. And so if you have stress-related genes, genes that release hormones or something in response to stress, if you are exposed to high stress incidents as a child, those genes will become permanently dysregulated so that they're always very active, that they always respond to stressful experiences in a very strong way. And that can be a permanent change in the way you respond to stress. So these epigenetic changes are how adverse childhood experiences really affect a person throughout their lifetime.
Would the timing of these experiences, particularly as it relates to early in life, also have a big important factor to play?
Sure, because young children don't have the ability to know how to respond to stressful situations. They just haven't had that experience. They haven't had a adult show them how to respond to a bad experience. Those kids are extremely susceptible to these epigenetic changes. If a bad thing happens to a 20-year-old or an 18-year-old or a 25-year-old, they've got a lot more experience with how to handle those stressful situations potentially, and they won't have those permanent epigenetic changes in their stress-related response that young kids will get.
I think it was maybe you that I stole this idea from, but also I often, when I've talked about this, is you get 80% of your adult head size by age 2 to 3, so there's a huge amount of change going on. And as we begin to have these experiences, it's much more likely to have long-term consequences. And the other kind of corollary idea is our brain turns out to be an excellent learning organ, but it's not very good at unlearning things. And so these early experiences in that way can shape experiences and outcomes in a lot of ways.
That's right. As your brain is developing, especially early on in life, there are all these different synaptic connections between all the different brain cells. And if you have bad things happening to a kid, all of a sudden your brain becomes wired in a very different way than a kid who didn't have those bad experiences. And that wiring can remain permanent if the experience goes on long enough and the child gets old enough. If you can intervene early, you know, in kids under the age of 3 or under the age of 5, depending on the study, you can change the way those wirings are happening to a more normal way, and the kid will develop much better.
So in a sense, we've all heard that if you want to teach somebody how to play baseball, you teach them early and correctly, and they're more likely to not have to relearn how to do it later.
It's way easier to do it right the first time than it is to try and fix it later. Uh-huh. Yep.
Uh-huh. William, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Oops. We lost our guest. So Jared, let's bring you in. So you're looking at child abuse and neglect in the state. Let's define those to get started.
Yeah, so this is a public health involvement on this. And so I think it's important for us to understand that we're looking at child abuse and neglect, but that is a very complex issue. And it can be defined in a variety of different ways. And so we've, here in the State Health Department, what we've done is we've really relied heavily on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they've provided us some definitions to utilize here. And so from a public health perspective, sometimes we're less interested on accurately defining whether maltreatment in fact occurred. There has been published paper after paper after paper trying to get an accurate measure of that. And in fact, a lot of people have just abandoned it. And so we've been interested in first contact with child welfare or social services, where someone in the community or a mandated reporter had a suspicion that something might be going on in that family, where it rose to enough for them to call in. And from a public health perspective, that can be a sentinel event that we can use to pinpoint and try to intervene on. And so this may include anything from neglect, poor parental supervision, substance use, physical and sexual abuse. And so it's this whole gamut of things. But from a public health perspective, we're really focusing in on that first contact with child welfare. Because from our perspective, if we can prevent that first contact, then maybe we can reduce some of these adverse experiences that kids are experiencing through their life.
So what I hear you saying is that defining abuse and neglect is so difficult, so uncertain, that that's not the best way to look at it. What we're going to look at instead is this other way, that reports which we can clearly document.
Well, I think from our public health perspective, it's difficult to define.
Okay.
We want to keep it absolved from any sort of legal connotation or legal definition, because we're not doing that. We're looking at it within the population context and really trying to find an upstream area where we can identify or have an early intervention. Just how we do with like cancers, we try to do screening, early intervention, detect early, and intervene early. So we're applying that same theory of disease to this as well.
I'm going to back off for just a second, since William, who was on our list to make a comment a minute ago, is back on, and then we'll come back to what you're doing in this state right now. So, William, you're on line one.
Yeah, thank you for your patience. I was kind of multitasking. It didn't work. But anyway, I can verify that what happens to you in your early childhood affects you in later life. I'm 71 years old now, and I do not get very far away from food. I do not let other people control my access to food, and I hoard food. What does that tell you? I spent a lot of my childhood, my very young years, going hungry. I would go to school hungry, come home hungry, go to bed hungry, because there was no food. And back in those days, schools didn't feed hungry kids. They didn't care. So, yeah, that's an experience that myself and my family will not forget, because I come from a very large family living in destitute poverty.
Right, right. Yeah,
so that verifies that what happened to you as a child molds, your behavior. I do not like going to bed hungry.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting comment. That some of the perhaps earlier work in epigenetics and so forth, both in humans and animals, relates around food and obesity and effects, particularly I'm thinking of some information that came out after the World War II, where there was quite a bit of starvation in certain groups of people and the consequences of that, which incidentally seems to be multi-generational. Matt has talked about how you get some change in your how the our genes respond to stimuli and control. And what's really kind of fascinating is that can go on not only in the offspring, in the individual, but the offspring of the individual. And I'll certainly happy to have Matt interject if he disagrees with that. But I think that really is foundational to me. So I appreciate your call, William. That makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Matt, any comments about the multi-generational aspect of this? I don't want to get too complex, but
no, I think you're right on. It's been shown that if you have stressful events in moms, that stressful event can be passed on to their baby through dysregulation of their stress hormones and stress response. And so,
yeah, another good point. Yeah. Yep. All right. So back to Jared. What are you doing?
What am I doing?
Tell me how you've been looking at this thing and. This issue.
So, we started with our conversation on adverse childhood experiences and the amount of literature that's being developed on showing early life experiences matter on to later life health. And so when I was looking at our systems that we have to understand this complex issue, I realized that we actually didn't have good data in the state for us to understand things that occur over an individual's life course, especially very early on experiences. And so I was in the literature, there's a variety of methodologies on things you can try to do for data linkages or integrating data that we already have. And some of them are incredibly complex and very cost prohibitive to our state. And so we were looking for an efficient way to understand longitudinally or over time the effects of early childhood experiences. And that's where we've developed the Alaska Longitudinal Child Abuse and Neglect Linkage Project.
Okay, tell us about it.
All right. So this project, it utilizes as a base the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, or PRAMS. And now that is a CDC-developed survey that samples in our state about 1 out of every 6 live births. And it's a representative systematic sampling. And it asks a variety of really important questions that occurred before birth, during pregnancy, and then shortly after pregnancy. And so we've utilized that base instead of using all births in the state of Alaska for 2 reasons. 1, they provide a lot of good information to us, and 2, they've consented to having their information integrated. And that's an important aspect that I think we need to realize, that these moms are already engaged in a research project, but now we're expanding the utility of this data set by linking it with other administrative data sources that we have, namely Child Protective Services, the permanent fund dividends, so we can account for when people leave the state, and a variety of other systems that we have.
Do you think it biases your selection group? Is it, and by that I mean, is it somehow that group you've picked going to affect your outcomes?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is precisely why the development of this has taken a couple of years. And so this actually was developed by a 3-way partnership between a private funder here in the state of Alaska, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the Department of Health and Social Services here. And through this 3-way partnership, we went through the vetting process of comparing it and validating it and trying to quantify how much bias we actually would have by using people who respond to a survey. And in fact, when we did do a trial linkage for just the 2009 birth cohort, and then we looked at the weighted estimates produced through the PRAM survey on kids reported to child welfare, it was within a percentage point of each other. So we're actually really confident that we don't have a lot of bias impacting our results.
And as I heard you say, it was a random selection of people who said they would be willing to do this.
Yeah, so it's a systematic random selection within that systematic process, yeah.
Okay. And So you told us how it was obtained, and how's that data used? Well, before I ask that, a lot of people get worried about privacy issues. What should we say about privacy?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. First of all, like I mentioned, the moms that respond to PRAMS have consented through implicit consent when they apply. And I got a shout out to these moms who are responding to this survey. I mean, it is vitally important that these moms do it, and we're learning so much information for them taking time out of their day to respond to this survey. Mm-hmm. And so when they get it and they respond to it, their information is safeguarded to the utmost that we can do. And so that information is integrated within the health department on their state servers, and it's not accessible. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way we make sure it's protected.
Okay. So now you got this information from pregnant women who've had a baby that's pretty valid selected group, not any more biased or reasonably unbiased.
Right.
You can't get an unbiased group, I guess. And, I mean, it's reasonable.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you did due diligence. And now what do you do with that information?
Yeah. So, you know, once you get some data, you start trying to make sense of it a little bit. And what we first wanted to do, one of the driving reasons behind doing this was we wanted to be able to measure the cumulative incidence to first report. So what is the probability that someone who's born in the state of Alaska is going to experience a maltreatment report to child welfare before the age of 7? Just like you might want to know what's the probability of getting heart disease before age 40. You might be interested in that type of statistic instead of how many 40-year-olds this year got heart disease.
Right.
And so we didn't have that piece of information related to child abuse and neglect. And so that was the driving force behind that, on understanding of kids born in the state, how many of them are going to be reported before their 7th birthday, and then by next year to be by their 8th birthday. And we're going to continue to follow them into young adulthood and hopefully into adulthood, so we can then study the effect of things like suicide, some other complex issues in our population.
All right, I want the answer, but I've had somebody who called in a little bit ago, and I want to get her on the line, and then we'll come back and see what you found. Terry, you're on line one.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call, and I truly appreciate the program. I just attended the viewing of the documentary Resilience that just was shown a few days ago. And my piece is that I am an adult who survived. I score just about everything on the ACEs questionnaire, and so do lots of adults. So the story doesn't end just because people survive and are over 18. We come into adulthood with very ineffectual ways to deal with life and relate to others due to all of this adverse experiences. But the 12-step fellowships in general, regardless whether it's substances or food or whatever, other gambling or sex, address all of these issues. These are the consequences of people trying to cope with all these adverse experiences that there's no place to take them to. And one in particular, and that's the one that I mainly think about as the most appropriate for a number of people, is adult children of alcoholics and dysfunctional families. Because not that many cases will be reported, that would be so extreme. For the majority of us, it was just an ongoing thing, day in and day out. We survived, we moved on, and yet here we have it with us. And then that's what we transfer to the next generation. I could only give what I had. There is, the fellowships have their own literature. In general, if people want to investigate more, it's adultchildrenofalcoholics.org. And we do have meetings here in Anchorage, and people can kind of visit, and it's all anonymous, it's free. And we live with guilt, shame, and abandonment. And those are not things easily detected. They certainly lead to a lot of stress and a lot of sickness. So, yeah, I think ACEs is wonderful, and thank you, and I'll be quiet now.
Terry, thanks very much for sharing, and we hope to get into some of the issues about resilience and protective factors later in the program. But thanks again. All right, Jared. So now you've linked this information from these pregnant women, and particularly you wanted to know what the cumulative incidence of reports to Protective Services up to 7 years.
Right, because that's where we have the data right now. So, in just to back up one step, when we think about the BRFSS data, the behavioral risk factor surveillance data,
what is that?
So that's the
don't just throw out these BFD numbers.
So, so Matt, you could probably explain that. Well, you use the data all the time.
I do. It's a telephone survey that is done with Alaska people from all across the state, and they ask a variety of questions, and that's actually where we get our ACEs data for Alaska. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, they started adding ACEs-specific questions. So we now have ACEs data for Alaska, and they ask a whole bunch of other questions around behavioral health issues. And they contact about 200 people a year, and every year they contact a different 200. So it's a really good statewide representation for how Alaska is doing from a behavioral health standpoint.
These are adults that are contacted?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Right.
And so they're asking, you know, thinking back before age 18, did you experience one of these 10 events?
Yep.
And so they're just doing the study that Kaiser did very early on. And when I was looking at the data here, it's saying that 2 in 3 adults report one or more of these adverse childhood experiences, or 67%. And when I was looking at our annual statistics for how many reports go into child welfare, it's on an annual basis, on an annual year, about 10% of the child population is reported. And I started thinking, man, those numbers are drastically different here. Mm-hmm. And so if we look at the cumulative risk, so instead of saying in an annual year, how much does it occur,
right,
over the lifetime, how much experience it, and we see that before the age of 7, 31% of our children born in the state of Alaska will be reported to child welfare. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean abuse or neglect, but it means that they've got that little indicator that we should, from a public health perspective, be interested in working on.
Yeah. Why did that happen?
Right.
What's the significance of that? It's an outlier, but 31% of kids are reported.
Well, and that was the challenge with a lot of this, is that we were operating under the notion that child abuse and neglect is a rare event, but it's actually not. It's actually a fairly common event, potentially.
All right. We're halfway through this program already. I need to remind listeners that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, again, is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a 1-minute break, then we'll continue to discuss how early childhood neglect and abuse is a problem for all Alaskans with Dr. Jared Parrish and Dr. Matt Hirschfeld. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guests are Dr. Jared Parrish. He is senior epidemiologist with the state of Alaska, section of maternal and child health, and Dr. Matt Hirschfeld. He is the director of maternal child services at ANMC. He's also president of the All Alaska Partnership, which is a nonprofit dedicated to decreasing child abuse and neglect in Alaska. We're discussing the evidence that early childhood stress and abuse can have lifelong consequences, and we're looking specifically now as the rates of neglect and abuse, at least as reported to Protective Services in Alaska, is affecting children in Alaska. If you have questions, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, and we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. If you our regular listener, you know that you can also re-listen to this program tonight between 8 and 9 p.m. on FM 91.1, and you can also go to our archives by going to alaskapublic.org and looking up the Line 1 link, and you can listen or have someone else listen to the program at any time by doing that. And also on the Line 1 link, you'll see a number of resources to very useful information about the topics in today's program. So, Dr. Parrish, you have got some information, and you have just told us that it looks like the cumulative incidence of children born in Alaska, 31% of them are at one time or another reported to Protective Services by age 7. And so, again, being the skeptic, that sure seems high.
Absolutely.
Tell me why I can trust that number.
Why you can trust that. That seems like the common question that I get. Yep. Is how can we trust that number? I think it seems high because we've never seen the cumulative incidence estimate before to begin with.
Yep.
We've always based our perception on how much maltreatment is occurring based on these annual prevalence estimates that are point-in-time estimates. And so it seems high because we had no previous reference for it. And then we're also using something like reports that come into child welfare. And then we're trying to extrapolate that into stressors that kids might be experiencing. And so, first of all, we've just had no context or reason for that number to sit. And now why we can trust that number is because in the state of Alaska, we are one of the only states that have basically an annual census of our population through the permanent fund dividend. Mm. And what it allows us to do is to measure that group of population, that those mothers who respond to PRAMs, over time very well on whether they remain in the state. And when they leave the state, they're no longer at risk for being, or their child's no longer at risk for being reported to child welfare, so we can stop following them. Mm-hmm. So because we have these really good administrative data sources in the state of Alaska, we can follow prospectively a really well-defined group of individuals over time. And from an epidemiologic perspective, the prospective cohort study is the strongest observational study design that we can have, and we've got that now at our fingertips.
So what are you going to do with this information?
Yeah, so I try to analyze it as much as I possibly can, but you know, usually the first question I get right after this is, how do we compare to other places?
Sure.
And the sad thing is that I don't know, because no other state has this information. But that was one of the reasons why we use the PRAMS survey, is that nearly all other states conduct that survey, and they can link their data to child welfare. And we're trying to create a methodology so we can have really good comparisons. Mm-hmm. But California, that linked their full population, their full birth to their child welfare, we found they followed through age 5, and we found that we have an elevated crude estimate of our cumulative incidence here in the state of Alaska relative to the state of California. But interestingly, when we looked at their cumulative incidence compared to their annual prevalence, the cumulative incidence showed that it was about 3 times that of the annual prevalence, which is exactly what we see here in the state of Alaska, 31% versus the 10% we see annually. Mm-hmm. So the cumulative incidence measure that we're measuring is very consistent across the board.
How about other countries? I'm thinking of countries in particular in my mind, maybe like Germany, Switzerland, and the Scandinavian countries, where they certainly are more interested early in life in the social economic effects on us. Do they have information like this that we might compare?
Yeah, one of the leading studies on understanding the complex dynamics of childhood and families, mm-hmm, is called the Children of the 90s study that's done over in England. And that study has produced a ton of research. But from these data linkage studies, really leading the game right now is in Australia and New Zealand, where they've done a lot of data integration over there. To really drive, and what's interesting is that everyone keeps driving the same point, is that early childhood intervention and prevention matter. And through these data sources that are becoming stronger through integration of resources, we're just gaining more evidence to tell that story.
So Dr. Hirschfeld helped us understand how the early childhood experiences can have long-term consequences. So basically what I'm hearing you say is that we now have a unique set of data, particularly for our country, that there appears to be a significant portion of our early childhood population that are reported to Child Protective Services suggesting that that population has had some significant experiences that may lead to long-term outcomes.
Yeah, so now it's our point now is to unpack that a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And to say, okay, well, if a kid who has one report who had a really good response and the family got supports they need and that trajectory was changed early on versus those that have a very complex life that need a ton of supports and how we can help change that trajectory to one degree. And the discussion we had very early on about epigenetics and about early exposures, because now really there isn't a lot of knowledge or a lot of information that has actually measured the timing of these adverse childhood experiences and the outcomes. And so now we have a data set in place where we can measure those things about when they occurred in a child's life and then
But
the
you
outcome.
Don't have information about the number of adverse experiences, right?
Well, we can accumulate them. We're accumulating them over time now.
So you're taking the reports and you're looking at what the reports were and how often that might happen to an individual?
Yep, and we can couple that information with information that is provided to us on the pregnancy or the PRAM survey.
Yeah.
And then unique in Alaska, we have a 3-year follow-up survey to PRAMs called CUB. So we can actually look at exposures that the family environment's in 3 years later too. Mm-hmm. So. You know, those 10 questions on ACEs are representative stressors. They actually asked a lot of other questions, too. But what they found that those 10 questions correlated together to predict these negative outcomes. And we've seen very similar things on using the PRAMS data, where we looked at stressors that moms reported that they experienced 12 months before pregnancy. And it might be being homeless and all those. And we added up all those. And we found the exact same dose response with the more adverse experiences that a mom reported during her pregnancy or before mm-hmm. was directly correlated with the higher likelihood that kid's going to be reported to child welfare.
Mm-hmm. So as Dr. Hirschfeld mentioned earlier, there's very, very good evidence also that the earlier you intervene, the better the likely outcomes. It would make sense to me that somebody would want to take this information and start prospectively looking at pregnant women with this information. Have we gotten to that point?
Well, I think we're starting to get there. And I think that the important thing for us to realize is that public health, it's built on a foundation of solid data. And for intervening on this complex issue, we haven't had really good comprehensive solid data to develop appropriate interventions. And now we're trying to leverage these data to help support different interventions and preventions. And I would even say that pregnant women is a good time to intervene, but we actually need to be thinking up even to like adolescent health,
right,
teaching them healthy relationships.
Right. All right. So I've been doing this long enough, and I'm hopefully not that naive, but facts and political will do not correlate. You're obviously generating data. Lots of people are interested in that data. What does it take to make change in a time when we're economically worried in this state?
Well, you could hear the pin drop after that question, huh, Matt?
No pressure.
Yeah.
You got this.
I'll give an opinion.
And I don't want to put you on the spot. I just want to make sure people that are listening, it's one thing to generate information. It's a hell of another thing to get people to change their minds on how they think about things and to act on those things. And that's what's so frustrating sometimes.
I think that the things that we're learning more and more, and Pat Sidmore has done some work on this to show the cost of not intervening early. And so if you can't get motivated around the fact that 31% of the kids born in the state will be reported to child welfare before age 7, mm-hmm. then maybe you can get motivated the fact that like $47 million is related to kids experiencing mm-hmm. adverse childhood experiences. And mm-hmm. and so there's this cost idea. But I think, you know, I'm a data guy. I create data and then I try to plug it into the right system. But when I look at what these data reflect into my life and the different initiatives we have going on in the state, it's not about government intervening. It's about government providing appropriate supports for families to operate and become a strong unit to rear children. I don't know how you change it.
Yeah. No. And I mean, it's maybe it was unfair of me to ask somebody who's clearly very, very, very regimented about doing this right. and that's different than the whole issue. There's those of us out here in the world, and I'm not one of those either, but there are those people who are very much into trying to make these, taking this information and make change. But that's not what you do for a living.
No. Yeah. But you know what? That's an important thing for me to be able to do. And that's why it's great that we're on this this program right now, having this conversation, trying to translate data into reality. Yeah. And we have a lot of really good initiatives going on in the state with the Strengthening Families Initiative, the Alaska Resiliency Initiative. We have the home visiting programs are going on. I think there's a lot of good things that are going on, like the Medicaid, the public health nurses. They're doing a lot of really good things, and these data can help support them in focusing their very limited resources on prevention and supporting families.
And I don't think you can underestimate the impact of having people like Jared on programs like this, too. It's all three of us are probably true believers in this. We all believe that early childhood is very important, but there are a lot of people who don't. And so the more evidence, the more people we can reach, the more education you can do, the more you're going to convert people to being believers in this. And once you convert enough people, all of a sudden the politicians start listening and government starts existing to provide the supports that Jared was talking about a little bit before. It takes years, but it's slow. But it will happen if we continue to push this.
Katie, thanks for hanging on. What can we do for you?
Hi. I just have a quick question. I was a child that lived in an alcoholic home and had psychological abuse. And I'm now 70, but at 63, I finally gave in and tried to commit suicide with workplace bullying. My question now is, I've gotten this far in life. What can I do to try to improve my quality of life now so that I can not react the way you've described children get set up to react when they're in this pressure at childhood?
Right. All right. Dr. Hirschfeld, you want to address that?
Well, I think, Katie, you've done an amazing job. Getting to 63, 70, and you've obviously got a lot of resilience, which is a word that was bandied about before, about making sure that this experience that happened to you as a kid or as a young person didn't permanently affect your life and didn't affect it. It didn't cause you to do something much more serious as a 20-year-old or as a 30-year-old. So you've got a lot of inherent ability around resilience, around another word that we use a lot is something called self-regulation, which is your ability to make your way through bad experiences to a place where you don't have some of the bad health outcomes we've been talking about. I think doing what you talking to people is a huge part of this. We've got some pretty good data just by a physician or a provider asking people about bad things that happened to them as kids. You can make that person less likely to go to the doctor, less likely to have a bad experience over the next year or a couple of years after you have that conversation. So talking to people, talking to mental health professionals, talking to your healthcare provider about these things and joining groups. I think it was Terry who was talking a little bit earlier about children of alcoholic parents, joining groups so that you can find a way to really share your experience and learn from other people's experiences about how to get through these experiences is a very powerful way to go. So it sounds like you're doing a really good job so far, and maybe just connecting a little bit more would be a great way to go from here on out.
Well, thank you. This program really hit me, and I appreciate hearing all this. Is there a support group for this type of thing specifically?
Terry was talking about that a little bit earlier.
I'm sorry.
I don't remember exactly what the website was, but she actually quoted the website. And if you go to, Line One Online, I'm plugging our own program here, and listen to us again, you'll be able to hear the website that she was talking about.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great day, you guys. You're all wonderful.
You too. And thanks for calling in.
And yeah, you're obviously not alone. Keep that in mind. Carolyn, you're on line one.
Yes, hi. Yes, good afternoon. This is Caroline. I wanted to, you folks touched on it, but I wanted to drive the nail home. The concept of money, unfortunately, we can't appeal to somebody unless we show them the dollars and cents. And I know that in the happiness scale, Norway is number one, and I think it's Denmark that's number two. And I've had people tell me, yeah, but Norway tax is so high. Yeah, 37% I think it is. But they have lifetime education and health care. Also, the females, or mothers, I should say, are allowed 2 years of time with their babies, and the fathers can have 1 year. That is covered by their the same amount of money that they would be earning at their jobs. Now, you take that amount of money and you contrast it to the yearly cost of having a child out at one of our institutions, and I think it is chewed up within 2 years to 3 years. And in Alaska, I was stunned to find out that many of the young women having children at our hospitals, they're turned out of there within 36 to 48 hours. Now, I realize we have better medical care, but my mother, 73 years ago, she had 2 weeks in the hospital. And without these programs, and of course we can report things to the different state agencies, but are there people there that can have the time to do the work when some of these folks are carrying 70 loads, 70 cases? So again, money, money, money. If we can just show that we pay now, or we pay a heck of a lot more later. And one final thing, is there a preponderance of leaders that have not had these problems, and so they don't have an understanding of what it's like to have the problem?
Yeah, it's that last is a good point, and I would hazard a guess that many, I don't know if leaders is the right word, but people in
areas of responsibility.
Yeah, decision-making roles are no different. I'm gonna say that. I don't think this is a low socioeconomic problem anymore. I don't think. At least I would guess that there's no evidence that that is involved only low socioeconomic groups are and that across the board the risks that we have talked about remain. I'd be interested in Matt and Jared your comments if you have any evidence about that comment because I'm always want to know if I'm wrong and why.
Well, so the literature continues to suggest that. People in a low socioeconomic environment are more likely to be reported to child welfare engaged in that system. And it's not because of that low SES. It's because of the distribution of other things that they're being exposed to. And when you actually start unpacking this a little bit more, what you find are some common threads, and we've heard some of them today. Substance use by caregiver, history of mental health issues, low social supports to be able to help in time of need, a variety of other stressors that are being experienced, and I think I've touched on some of the major ones right there, but those are kind of some of these underlying themes that have to be addressed in an individual's life, and that's why there's really been this push for building resiliency among parents and caregivers and new individuals. So.
Yeah, so I knew that, and I didn't think about that as clearly. One of the questions that comes to my mind when you said that low socioeconomics are more likely to be reported, is that a biased statistic in some way?
You know, I've read a few different studies that have identified that there is definitely a potential for some bias, and it's been difficult to quantify that bias because, you know, it's hard for an educator, it's hard for a clinician to sometimes differentiate between whether this is abuse or this is just lack of resources. And so there's research that's trying to unpack that a little bit. So there's probably absolutely a bias. But what ends up happening is that when you look among that group, that low SES group, you find a large proportion that have a bigger exposure to some of these other underlying factors. And so intervening on those underlying factors. And so sometimes it just might be a good population to target limited resources towards.
Do we have some good information to share about costs that were brought up by Caroline, societal costs related to these issues?
Well, I think the person who's done the most on this in the state is a guy named Pat Sidmore from the Alcohol Mental Health Board down in Juneau. And he's starting to relate ACEs scores to costs, as well as what would happen if we, as a society in Alaska, decreased our ACEs score. What would that save us in the long run? Mm-hmm. And one of the really cool things that he's done is he's looked at if Alaska as a state decreased our cumulative ACE score by 0.5 point, We would actually save around $90 million as a state in just six measures, which is, you know, heart disease and alcoholism, and not the 75 different things that have been discovered to be linked to adverse childhood experiences. So I think the caller had a great statement. It was either we can pay now or we can pay a whole lot more later, and that's been shown over and over.
And so the evidence is that. And I can't help but mention that when the original ACEs study was done, it came out of people looking at why people were having trouble with obesity.
So what
was leading people to have obesity was, it turned out, ACEs-like stuff. I mean, so getting back to all the health consequences of early childhood experiences, that kind of almost epitomizes, it's not just about suicide, and it's not just about things like that. It affects us in a large degree of everything we do.
The other thing about the original ACEs study, too, is it was the population they were looking at was kind of an upper middle class population in San Diego. So this happens to all socioeconomic groups. Yeah. It's not just lower.
Thanks for saving me a little bit there.
Yeah.
on my comments about. So let's talk about protective issues, resilience. What do we know? Have you been able to glean anything in your work?
Yeah, so that is right on the top of the list of my whiteboard of things to really start unpacking a little bit. And that's what's really nice about having the PRAMS data and this CUBS data is we can look at some of the protective effects of like family cohesion. We can look at supportive adult in the child's life. And we just haven't had the time yet to unpack that a little bit. And so right now we're still relying heavily on a lot of national data that has been directing towards building resilience.
I put a link on our website that addresses the cost issues in a completely different way, maybe a corollary way, and that's a website called the Heckman Equation, which is based on the work of a Nobel Prize-winning economist who did his work on and basically showing that it was extremely cost-effective to put a lot of money, the earlier the better, into children. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's very fair to say. And if you even go back further, I think Jared mentioned this earlier, if you put a lot of money into programs that affect women who are pregnant, you even your rate of return or how much money you get back is even higher. Mm-hmm. So, and I would argue that adolescent girls would be another great place to put a lot of money into. Getting them ready to become pregnant would increase your rate of return even more.
And boys. Healthy relationships,
sure.
I think, is a key component in there. If we could, and when you're thinking about the investment you're making in there and helping support relationships, it's a lot less than trying to deal with the effects later on in life.
Yep.
So I'm just thinking off the top of my head again, I'm a big fan of parenting classes, although one of the things that bothers me about parenting classes is a couple of things. One, we almost require women to have delivery or some education on the delivery, which they may or may not get a chance to use, but we don't require anybody to have any parenting classes. And part of the problem with parenting classes is both parents are working. It's hard to find the time while you have a baby, whereas other countries are giving parents more time to be able to do it. So some benefits to having this more time available to learn about children early. And then the other thought that comes to mind, when I first came up here, public health nurses used to go into the homes and make visits and almost all babies that were born, and that went away. I'm sure it was a cost factor.
But the public health nursing, they're still doing a lot of good work with the limited resources they have. And they have a systems approach to child maltreatment. They have a family approach and an individual approach that they're trying to develop. And Matt, maybe it's a good plug for the Strengthening Families curriculum, where that's just trying to interject some things into the things we're already doing.
Right. I mean, it's a similar thing where you're trying to strengthen the family, you're trying to build resilience in the family, and you're trying to build a situation where you're going to maximize the ability of families to take care of young kids and maximize their potential. So all that home visiting programs from public health nurses, all these programs that target families with young kids or young kids have been shown to just to be extremely cost effective and make society as a much healthier society over time.
Let me make one more. We're in the last 4 minutes or so. Comment to it in a broader sense about it. I started this program by saying that socioeconomic factors are more important to population health than health care. And I want to continue on that line of saying of thinking about by pointing out that our country spends more per capita than any other developed country on health care. Yet our rates are lower than many in the overall evaluation of population health. So we spend a lot. We're not getting as much bang for our buck. In addition, when you look at the data, we spend less per capita on social issues, yet we also see that social factors that, like we've discussed today, contribute significantly to health. So countries that spend more on social issues seem to be fare better on population health evaluation. Is there a real link, I have written here, between efforts to address social contributions to health and health outcomes? Have we in the U.S. been spending too much money on all the wrong places, and why might this be?
I'll add one comment to that,
and then like Matt, it's all you.
This is much better.
Whenever I hear those statistics, it's hard because the U.S. is a huge country with a variety of social groups and very distributed, whereas sometimes in the European countries, they're very homogenous and they have a very smaller system. So I like to break it down into Alaska. And so in Alaska, have we been investing in the wrong places? And I would argue yes, based on what the data continue to show. And that if we really want to see change in our overall population health, we really do need to be thinking upstream into helping families create an environment that is healthy to rear children in.
I would agree with you, Jared. I think if you look at how much money Alaska spends on programs that affect early childhood and the fact that every year we have to go and protect those programs from being cut, I think it really suggests that Alaska may not be spending its money quite as wisely as it could over time.
All right. So last question. What is the most important message that are one or two or maybe three, since people are not going to remember a lot, messages that we want people to remember about the program today? Jared, I'm going to start with you.
I would first say that here in the state, we're trying to be incredibly fiscal responsible with the limited resources we have. And so we're creating data sets that can help direct those resources to the most appropriate populations that need the most support and help. And then second, the data continue to support that focusing on early childhood, early is when we need to be focusing on doing prevention so that we're not reacting to situations later in life.
And I would second exactly what Jared said and add in, if you care about these topics, if you care about early childhood, you care about families with young kids, getting involved by calling your legislator and by going to town hall meetings and really trying to make your voice heard above the din of everything else is going to be important to protect these programs and expand the programs in the future. I think the political process can be a little bit intimidating, but if you believe in this stuff, you should really contact your politicians because those are the guys who are decision makers and they're controlling the purse strings. So.
This has been one of those highlights of my career. I really appreciate the time and effort that both of you have put into this issue, and hopefully we've gotten across to a few people out there the importance of what you're doing. My thanks to Drs. Jerry Parrish and Dr. Matt Hirschfeld to continue this discussion on child abuse and neglect and how it can affect brain development and causes even lifelong health problems. You can join KSK on Facebook. And you can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you also find the Line 1 archives. You can also let us know your thoughts and suggestions at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So next week, we're going to look at another source of effects on our developing brain when we talk about preventing fetal alcohol exposure and its effects on Line 1, your health connection. That'll be Monday, August 21st at 2 p.m. Eric Bork engineered today's program, and he's also our web editor. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.